It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps. Can anger be a force for good?
San Antonio, please come forward.
I was in the airport in Charlotte, North Carolina, on a flight to somewhere, and I remember walking around and watching the TV monitors and seeing the news.
Activist Brendan Steinhauser.
Rick Santelli is on CNBC Live on the floor of the Chicago Board of Mercantile Exchange.
The government is promoting bad behavior.
And he's talking to traders, and there was this moment where he kind of had this righteous indignation, this moral outrage.
This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
Everyone around me was glued to the television screens, sitting there with anger, with outrage, with fear.
President Obama, are you listening?
And they were wondering, how did we get into this mess and how are we going to get out of it?
We're
thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July. All you capitalists that want to show up to Lake Michigan, I'm going to start organizing.
What was interesting was that Rick was very upset, and he was sort of channeling this energy and this anger and outrage in a very specific place. But it was also happening outside. It was happening at that airport in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was happening down in Fort Myers. It was happening in a suburb of Kansas City where one of the early protests occurred. The idea of channeling that anger, channeling that energy, was very powerful. We were overwhelmed in the numbers that we were seeing across the country leading up to this massive rally in D.C. on September 12th. I remember, as the main organizer of this event, you know, hoping and praying that we would get 250,000 people to show up. That was really the number that I was hoping for. And I remember at 5 a.m., it was dark, and I walked onto the platform there at Freedom Plaza, and there was a guy sleeping in his car, and he had an American flag and a Gadsden flag. And I kind of tapped on his door and I said, hey, time to get up, time to rally. And he kind of was groggy and woke up and got out of the car, grabbed his flag, and we were the first ones on the platform. And we just kind of stood there and took it all in, and we looked down Pennsylvania Avenue at the Capitol. And within 4 hours, hundreds of thousands of people were marching. And that's when I knew that we had created a historic political force that was going to make huge changes in our country.
Brendan Steinhauser. He and other activists from Freedom Works organized the Taxpayer March on Washington back in 2009. It's considered the largest gathering of fiscal conservatives ever held at the Capitol. Activists like Brendan use anger to spark protests and build movements for social change. Anger propelled Donald Trump to the White House. It's changing political alignments all over Europe. And we're going to talk about that this hour. But first, let's think about the kind of anger we're all most familiar with. Ordinary, everyday rage. So I was at an airport recently, waiting in the security line, and there was an agent who was just being gratuitously rude to everyone, barking orders, snapping at people, and acting like we were all stupid. Everybody online was fuming. But you know, what do you do with that? I think I muttered that she was a jerk and then treated myself to an extra large coffee. But psychologist Lisa Feldman Barrett would say, I missed an opportunity. Lisa runs a lab where she studies emotions, and she says that if you pay attention, everyday anger can be a source of wisdom. She tells Raymond Tangekar why.
Buddhism teaches, for example, that anger is a form of ignorance. And if you're in your car, for example, someone cuts you off, you might feel really angry. And this anger is born essentially of not understanding the driver's perspective. So maybe the driver is rushing a sick child who's hurt to the hospital, or maybe the driver is late for a particularly important meeting. This is another way that anger can be instructive. You can use anger as a signal to ask yourself, what is the other person's perspective? And if you do this, it allows you to use anger as a cue, really as a form of wisdom, that allows you then to dissolve it.
Oh, that's fat. Anger is a form of wisdom?
That's a fascinating concept.
Yeah, so I think sometimes cultivating anger can be useful because it reminds you as a cue to try to take the perspective of another person. Sometimes anger is useful because it reminds you that you care deeply about something and gives you the sense that you're part of a group.
But I would think that there's also kind of a danger with that, especially in a political context, in that it could lead to maybe feelings of contempt and unwillingness to compromise or talk with, you know, your political adversaries.
Absolutely. Every emotion can be used for good or ill. You know, every emotion can be, even happiness can be a form of wisdom or a potential pitfall for your behavior. I think in anger, especially these days in this political moment, anger can feel empowering, particularly when you are around like-minded people. You feel validated. That energizes you to act. The problem, of course, is that one thing that binds people together in anger is having a common outgroup, you know, a common group who you all disagree with.
Hmm. And so, like, how would one cultivate constructive anger without feeding into that division between in-group and out-group?
Well, I think, again, the thing to do is to use your anger as a cue to take somebody else's perspective and be curious about their perspective, to remind yourself to stop and think and listen, you know. And this has been shown in research to be very useful. So, for example, there's research with Palestinians and Israelis to teach them how to use their anger constructively to negotiate more peaceful and conciliatory resolutions.
What you're saying, it would seem kind of counterintuitive, right? I mean, I would think that a lot of people, you know, myself included, think of anger as kind of this corrosive emotion, something that it stands in the way of rational thinking. But it sounds like what you're saying is that that line between emotion and reason is getting blurred.
It's always been a fiction to some extent that we use in Western civilization. Scientists have believed really since the beginning of research into the brain that there are parts of the brain for emotion, parts of the brain for rationality, and they're in some kind of grand battle. So, you know, your mind is a battleground. This is a cherished narrative, but it actually doesn't reflect the structure of the brain at all. There are no parts of the brain for thinking versus feeling. Your brain is not a battleground between rationality and emotionality.
Huh. That's remarkable. Up until this point, I thought that when we feel angry or when we feel some kind of emotion, there's a specific portion of the brain that just like lights up with activity. You're saying that's not the case. So what happens when I feel angry?
What's really happening in your brain is that it's structured metabolically to predict. So, for example, right now, it may seem to you as if you're listening and reacting to every single word that comes out of my mouth. But in fact, your brain is predicting the sounds it's going to hear based on the statistical regularities of what's occurring right now. So in the same way, when you're in traffic on the highway and someone starts to move into your lane, even before you consciously see that person moving into your lane, your brain will start to predict what's going to happen next. It'll start to prepare a variety of actions. And then if the car moves, you'll react in a way that feels very reactive to you because you weren't aware of the predictive part of it.
So as a car is moving into my lane to cut me off, you're saying like the feeling of anger that's brewing in me isn't me reacting to the car. It's just my brain predicting how to react based on previous models?
That's right. So the way that I would break it down is to say something like this. Just as a large company has a financial office that keeps track of revenues and expenditures for multiple budgets, you also have a financial office for your body, for all the systems in your body. That's your brain. So, for example, if you go from a sitting position to a standing position, your brain has to anticipate that and change your blood pressure so that oxygen can make it to your brain so that you don't faint. And it does this predictively. And so what it's doing is when it perceives a threat, a potential threat, even a threat in a moral sense, it is adjusting the internal systems of your body, which gives you this very strong, intense feeling, which you make sense of as, say, moral outrage, for example.
And what should one do when they feel that sense of, like, that threat? Or is there anything they can do to kind of assuage that?
Yeah, there is. This is the most exciting aspect of the work that we do and that other researchers are doing as well with respect to managing your own emotions. So currently, the kinds of strategies that we offer people are things that they can do in the moment. But that's actually really hard to do. When you're feeling intense unpleasantness that's distressing to you, it's really hard for you to dial that down in the moment. That requires a tremendous amount of effort, and it's often, you know, sometimes not possible to do. So there are things that you can do, though, before those moments that will decrease the likelihood that you'll feel moral outrage. For example, one thing you can do is learn new emotion words. Words are linked to concepts that your brain uses effortlessly as the guesses that are your basis for your emotion. So try to learn the distinction, for example, between irritation, frustration, and outright rage.
How does that lead to positive outcomes?
The more words you use that you learn, the more facile you get with using them, the better your brain is at tailoring your actions to the specifics of the situation. You can think of it as, instead of having a little red toolbox, you have one of those massive, you know, contractor toolboxes. So you have a lot of tools at your disposal. Or another analogy would be you can become a sommelier, you know, of your emotions. making the ability to construct emotions with fine-grained distinctions really helps your brain control your actions. It also actually helps your brain just work more effectively, be more metabolically efficient.
I guess the thing I'm wondering, though, is, you know, I can recognize anger on someone else's face, you know, even when they won't admit it, or even if they're not aware of it. And so I'm wondering,
how do you know, though, Raymond? How do you know when you're recognizing anger and they don't admit it? How do you know you're right?
Sure, but I mean, they're frowning. They may have a scowl on their face. I mean, their face is like a telltale giveaway, right?
Absolutely not. A face does not speak for itself when it comes to emotion. Yeah, there's really fabulous research on this. So what you're doing, what feels really automatic to you, just in the same way that, you know, you look around and you see stuff in the world and that feels automatic to you. The stuff is there. The information makes its way to your brain. You see it. It just feels like it's very reflexive. But that's actually not how you see. It's not how you hear. It's not how you taste. And it's not how you feel. So to you, it may seem like you look at someone's face, they're scowling, and that means they're angry. But I can tell you, for example, my husband makes a classic stereotyped scowl face when he's concentrating really hard. He's done it for as long as I've known him, basically 23 years or something. But you do many things in anger. You can shout in anger, scowl in anger, smile in anger, laugh in the face of anger. And you also smile at times when you're not angry, and you can also scowl at times when you're not angry. So what your brain is doing is it's seeing a scowl and making sense of that, what that means, in the context of everything else that's going on in the moment.
You're causing me to question all of my personal interactions with other people up to this point.
Awesome. one of the points that I make is that our sense of certainty about our own perceptions in the world is not evidence that we're right. And one of the best things that we can do in order to get along and get ahead in life, frankly, is to be curious about other people and really set aside the notion that you know. You know, be humble and consider the fact that what to you feels like recognition is just a guess. And it might be a really well-informed guess, but you also might be wrong and you might really learn something.
Psychologist Lisa Feldman Barrett runs a lab at Northeastern University, and she's the author of How Emotions Are Made. Raymond Tankekar talked with her. Coming up, there is so much political anger around the world right now. It's fueling terrorist attacks and new nationalist movements. And our next guest blames Voltaire and Rousseau. how the 18th century Enlightenment led to 21st century rage next. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about anger in this hour, and there's a lot of it right now, all over the world. Terror attacks in Europe, hate crimes in the U.S., populist leaders everywhere spouting nationalist slogans that just a few years ago would have been unthinkable. Writer Pankaj Mishra traces the roots of contemporary political rage back to a kind of surprising source, the 18th century Enlightenment. Steve Paulson caught up with him to talk about his new book, The Age of Anger.
You have written a very timely book here with the election of Donald Trump, the Brexit vote, all the populist movements springing up around Europe. But you trace the politics of anger way back to the Enlightenment thinkers of the 18th century. Why do we need to know this history to understand our current political moment?
I do think we need to reacquaint ourselves with that history, with this particular history, and re-examine the ideals of the modern world as they were formulated in the late 18th century, mainly by the Enlightenment philosophers, the ideals of liberty, equality, of commerce, of trade, the pursuit of wealth, of intellectual sophistication.
And then this was the period that really kind of booted the church out of the governing values of our society, and marketplace values came in as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is the crucial change. And I think we really absolutely have to understand what happened there was that we moved away from older forms of hierarchy and authority and embarked upon this extraordinarily radical adventure of using human reason to build society and to define its laws and to define the rules of political community. This was the great adventure that we embarked upon back then. So if we are examining political anger, which is pretty much universal today, then we have to go back to that moment when we started to liberate ourselves from the church, from traditional religion, from the authority of divinely ordained kings and that kind of thing.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of the Enlightenment, when this dream of a modern rational state was first articulated by two French philosophers who were rivals, Voltaire and Rousseau. They had diametrically opposed ideas about what a good society should be, and you suggest that to a certain extent, we're still stuck in their arguments.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, those differences are absolutely crucial, I feel, to understanding where we are today, because in many ways they kind of map onto our contemporary divisions between the metropolitan elite and the angry, disaffected masses who blame the elites for their suffering and for their plight. Voltaire, I mean, I think, you know, someone who advocates free trade, who's all for commerce, who wants free speech, at least for himself and for the intellectuals, doesn't have much time for the masses, doesn't really have much time for people essentially belonging to social classes inferior than his, but very extremely ambitious. He believes that he's kind of found the right kind of formula for moving on from older forms of hierarchy and authority. And then you have Rousseau, who's from Geneva, an outsider in Paris, who feels slighted, who feels humiliated by this sort of glamorous world of the Parisian elites, among which, you know, the Enlightenment philosophers revolve. And he thinks that these new ideals of status, of wealth, of vanity, competitiveness, are going to leave human beings extremely unhappy, and they're going to cause deep internal conflicts, which turns out that he was not entirely wrong.
Hmm. And these were contemporaries, Voltaire and Rousseau, and they hated each other, didn't they?
They hated each other for all kinds of reasons. I mean, there was a great class divide between the two, and temperamentally they were very, very different. Rousseau, of course, had a lot of what we would identify today as psychological problems. He was a very peculiar man in many ways. Voltaire was a man of the world, you know, extremely cultured, urbane, a great socialite, a great lover of wealth, a great lover of powerful people. Rousseau hated all that. He disliked rich people. He did not want to be in the company of powerful people. He avoided their company, in fact. So very different in all kinds of ways. And also, most importantly, different in their views of the good life or what mm-hmm. what the good life consists of.
Well, I'm curious about your take on this new era that we have, the politics of anger, or you could call it the politics of resentment, because my sense is that even though you're clearly not sympathetic to, say, the Brexit vote or the election of Donald Trump, at least I don't think you are, my sense is that you have some sympathy for this politics of resentment.
I think that's a fair summary of my attitudes. And, you know, I think one reason one is compelled, in a way, to feeling sympathy for those positions, you know, even though I'm not at all sympathetic to the Brexiteers, and needless to say, nor do I love Donald Trump, but I can understand why people voted for him or why people voted for Brexit. I do think we have to make an effort to understand the rage and despair and frustration that drove people, many people, into making these unwise political choices. And without that act of sympathetic understanding, I think we'll simply perpetuate these divisions between the aloof, metropolitan, technocratic elites and the masses who feel that these elites are simply feathering their own nests, who are engaged in this project of self-aggrandizement and leaving everyone else behind, and not just behind, but kind of pushing them behind and disdaining them and scorning them. And you know, these are the polarities that we see today in the United States and many other countries today, in kind of almost a kind of civil war, low-intensity civil war.
Now, there is a different explanation for the rise of Trump and the people who supported Brexit and these emerging nationalist movements in Europe, the right-wing movements, and that's the reaction to fundamentalist Islam, to the threat of terrorism in Europe and the Middle East, this is what they are there to protect us against those forces.
Well, I think that was a catastrophic mistake that many of us made after 9/11. We were obsessed with Islam. People made entire careers out of our portraying Islam as a religion that seems to offer a special legitimacy to acts of violence. And
well, there certainly are still a lot of people who say that.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a whole industry out there, and it's very well funded by all kinds of institutions, shady people. Billions of dollars have been spent on this. But, you know, intellectually, it's a dead end. Terrorism has a long history, which has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with specific socioeconomic pressures, which become intolerable at certain times. And the people who find those pressures intolerable often resort to terroristic violence. And, you know, you can trace this history right back to the late 19th century, to the Russians, to the Spaniards, to the Italians, who first resorted to anarchist violence or terroristic violence. And there were no Muslim terrorists in sight back then. What we have seen in recent years is not just terrorism in Muslim countries, but also in Buddhist countries, among Sikh populations. We've seen that among the Hindu majority population of India. So it is certainly not particular to any religious community. I've just come back from spending a month in Myanmar, where Buddhist monks are leading ethnic cleansing mobs. Now, how does one explain that? Does Buddhism sanction violence? The answer is no, of course not.
And you take the argument even further. I mean, sort of the kind of the radical thing that you say is there's actually a lot of similarity between some of these fundamentalist religious groups and the nationalist groups you see popping up in the U.S. and Europe. To some degree, they're both reacting against sort of this move towards modernism, and none of them like it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the argument of the book is that we have to look beyond binary oppositions, Islam versus the West, liberalism versus Islam, or the West versus the East. We have to really start thinking of the world as, you know, constituted by sameness. And so if you're a white nationalist in the United States or in Scandinavia, if you're an unemployed Muslim graduate in Egypt or a poorly paid wage slave in India, what unites all these experiences is a sort of shared feeling of powerlessness, of humiliation, of marginality, of exclusion. This is what we should be focusing on.
So to come back to the promise of the Enlightenment, I mean, this was supposed to deliver humanity, the modern world, into this new age that was, you know, going to be more rational, be more humanistic, not going to sort of follow the old outdated rules of the church. But a lot of that promise seems unfulfilled. And I guess the question is, so where does that leave us?
This is where I feel it's imperative to examine the ideals of the Enlightenment more closely. I mean, you know, we've allowed ourselves to be dazzled by them. We have started worshiping them as a kind of substitute god.
What do you think we're worshiping?
Well, I think, you know, simply saying that progress is irreversible, is inevitable, and now we have embarked upon this path of equality and liberty and prosperity, and that more and more people are going to be benefiting. This is a kind of fantasy that, especially in the last three decades, has become very, very intoxicating for many people. But can we actually realize them without running huge risks, political risks? And of course, we haven't even talked about the great threat to the environment, the fact that the ideals of prosperity that have been realized by a tiny minority of Europeans and Americans, are they really fulfillable for the hundreds of millions, billions literally, of Indians and Chinese who also want them?
Right. And of course, globalization was supposed to lift all boats, right? I mean, it was supposed to make everyone prosper.
This is what I'm saying. Like, you know, we are looking at utterly fantastical projects. You know, we've moved into a realm of total fantasy with these notions that globalization, I mean, these are just empty metaphors. You know, globalization is going to lift all boats. There's going to be trickle down, and, you know, the benefits of economic growth will eventually be available to all. Well, the anger today, so much of it arises from the fact that these promises were false. And, you know, there was no way these promises were going to be fulfilled. So, you know, here we are in a kind of impasse, really, where so much of what we believed in has been exposed as essentially false.
Pankaj Mishra, he's the author of Age of Anger, A History of the Present. Steve Paulson talked with him. In 1978, in San Francisco, a terrible crime took place. Harvey Milk, one of the country's first openly gay elected officials, was assassinated. Cleve Jones was a young activist at the time, and Harvey's protege. He's also the guy who later came up with the AIDS quilt. And what he remembers is how the gay community channeled anger and grief into a night he'll never forget.
You know, I had never seen a dead body, and to walk in there and see him, to see what the bullets had done, was the most horrifying experience of my life. I remember, you know, sitting in his office while they bundled up the bodies, and I just kept thinking, it's over, it's over. And then the sun went down, and there was this enormous march of tens and thousands of people in absolute silence, this river of candles. And I remember standing in that and realizing, you know, it was not over, it was just beginning, and that out of this tragedy was growing power. Harvey loved birthday parties, and that first birthday without him, I knew we had to have a party for him. And so I arranged to close Castro Street and got my friends to build a stage, and that was May 22nd, 1979. Of course, we had no idea that the verdict would come in the day before, in the trial of Dan White, the man who killed Harvey Milk and George Moscone. Dan White basically got away with murder. He was convicted of manslaughter. And I found out about the verdict when a reporter called me in my apartment. My first reaction was to vomit. I just ran into the bathroom and was very, very sick to my stomach. And by the time I got out of the bathroom and pulled myself together, my apartment was already filled with people who were just in a state of fury. People began to gather very quickly on Castro Street, and the crowd, it was probably around 5,000.
I think today is a really terrible day for the gay people of San Francisco. So maybe we can start moving down.
The crowd just kept growing and growing.
Out of the bars, into the street.
When we got to City Hall, the crowd stopped and it became overwhelming, and then the police sent in a line of cops to protect the front door, and we had no ability to communicate with the crowd, and it kind of fell apart from there. As it got darker, the crowd got larger, the police didn't know what to do. And then one young woman named Amber Hollibaugh bellowed at the crowd.
I don't think it's wrong for us to feel like we do. I think we should feel like it more often. Yeah.
And then the crowd just went nuts. A lot of rocks started flying, and the police retreated inside the building, and then people began to just swarm throughout Civic Center Plaza. I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. There was no part of me at that point that wanted any kind of violence. And I also felt some sense of responsibility and anxiety that I would be blamed for anything that happens. At some point, the cops made a big line and marched into the crowd in an attempt to disperse it. And the crowd began to flee. And it was then that I witnessed one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in my life. And as the crowd was being chased by this line of cops, the crowd panicked and began to run away. A lot of us became concerned that somebody was going to get trampled. And we started chanting, "Slow down, don't run. Slow down, don't run. Slow down, don't run, turn around, fight back. Slow down, don't run, turn around, fight back." And this chant spread through this crowd of tens of thousands of people, and everybody slowed down, stopped running, turned around, and hurled themselves against the police. And the cops panicked, and they turned and ran out of Civic Center Plaza and left behind a dozen or more police cars, which were then burned. Like almost every gay, lesbian, trans person in San Francisco at that time, I had personally experienced verbal and physical abuse at the hands of the police. So there was a kind of exhilaration to see them running away from us. It simultaneously felt very frightening and also very right. It was very interesting what happened the following day, because we had Harvey's birthday party and 50,000 people showed up on Castro Street ready to fight. And standing on the stage on Castro Street, I watched as tens of thousands of people poured in and filled the entire two-block area. And I was just sensing the crowd and trying to imagine what I needed to say to people to keep them focused on Harvey and to avoid further violence. And I said something to the effect that last night we had shown the world that the lesbians and gay men of San Francisco were angry and on the move, and that tonight we were going to show them what we're building out of that anger and that movement, a strong community. My favorite memory of that whole night is when it was over and the crowd was gone, the street was still shut down, and the cops stayed away. And there were just small groups of people standing in the street, hugging each other, and someone who had maybe too much to drink started screaming about Harvey, and all these people went and embraced this man and calmed him and then began to sing Happy Birthday to You.
Happy birthday, dear Harvey.
That's my favorite memory of that night. If one ever wanted to really know what solidarity feels like, that's what it felt like, to be in that crowd of so many thousands and thousands of total strangers and to feel such safety and such security and such a connection to each other. You know, this is part of who gay people are, or who we were then at least, that one night we could riot and burn police cars and the next night we could gather and dance in the street to Sylvester and sing Happy Birthday to Harvey Milk and have a beer and make out. And I think everyone had a sense that they were part of making history.
Cleve Jones is the author of When We Rise, My Life in the Movement, a miniseries based on it recently aired on ABC, and the archival footage we heard is from the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI.
This is my life.
Public Radio International. We're talking about anger in this hour, and there's a lot of vitriol out there these days. Partisan sniping on social media, screaming matches on cable news, not to mention the early morning tweet storms from certain elected officials. Frankly, it's exhausting. Also infuriating, blood-boiling, and maddening, so why can't we just let it go? Maybe because we as a nation are addicted to anger. At least that's what science fiction writer and astrophysicist David Brin believes. In fact, he wrote an open letter to addiction researchers and psychologists asking them to investigate America's epidemic of self-righteous indignation.
The big picture on addiction is very, very simple. We have an ability to be addicted because it helps us to survive. We get addicted to our children, and that helps us to be decent parents and put in the work. We get addicted to music and joyful things and our friends. What heroin and other drugs do is they hijack this reward system. And the worst, most destructive habit that releases the same chemicals, endorphins and kephalins, dopamine, is self-righteous indignation.
Okay, explain this, because I think most people would not think of self-righteous indignation as releasing a pile of neurochemicals that we'd find addictive.
Well, think about it. So many other mental states can be addictive. This is absolutely proved. Why not a mental state that has helped people throughout thousands of years to be strong in the face of anger? If you're self-righteously indignant, you have the power and will to pick up that spear, to pick up that sword, to pick up that legal brief, and go into combat. Self-righteousness and indignation aren't all bad. Sometimes they're called for. The people who marched with Martin Luther King, for example, the people who fought back against Hitler. But the problem is that whenever you enter a mental state that's addictive, you have a tendency to go back to it, and then back to it, and then back to it again. And if I asked your listeners to look into a mirror and be honest, whether or not they've ever been really, really indignant, of course everybody, if they're honest, would raise their hands. But then the second question is, didn't it feel good? Didn't it feel good to be so righteous, to be so right, to know that you're among the lonely few who know what's going on and fighting against the oppressors? Anybody left or right in our country would have to admit, yeah.
But the thing I don't get is why you think that's actually physically addictive or pleasurable. Do people really enjoy being angry?
Oh, well, now, Anne, if after this interview is over, please look in a mirror and try to remember some of the times when you were righteous, when you knew you were right, and authority figures were so wrong.
David, I'm afraid that's every day.
Yes, and there's a voluptuousness to it.
So this is a little scary because you're talking about neurochemical pathways that we've turned into superhighways. How are we supposed to change that?
Well, I think that it's terribly important that we recognize that there are powers on the left and the right and all over the spectrum that want us afraid because then we're more easily manipulated. And a fearful mind is more resistant to facts. And we've been seeing this in our culture where it's really hard to refute anything if the clinging to your side's point of view is boosted by not only self-righteousness, but fear.
I was going to say that, you know, the addiction analogy only goes so far. I mean, for instance, while self-righteousness maybe can be irritating and annoying, it's not like it's killing people, you know, like an opioid epidemic. So is this dangerous?
Well, tell that to the poor Sikh gentleman who was shot dead in his driveway by someone who indignantly and self-righteously thought he was an enemy because he wore a turban. No, I'm not claiming that self-righteousness is directly responsible for as much death as heroin, but I think it's responsible for far more damage in that it destroys our ability to see the commonalities in each other, to recognize that the indignant and self-righteous person at the other end of the spectrum is responding to the same mythologies, the same suspicion of authority, the same caveman fears, all these things that come together in a mishmash that has destroyed the ability of the one republic that ever existed on the face of the earth that was based on logic, that was almost Vulcan in its belief that we can negotiate, compare facts, and come up with reasonable compromise solutions. That's what our parents in the greatest generation did when they overcame depression and Hitler and contained communism and built fantastic industries and a mix of government and private enterprise.
Well,
the greatest generation
would
be ashamed of us right now for being so illogical.
Well, you could also say this country was founded by deeply self-righteous, indignant people. I mean, you know, think about the American Revolution.
Well, I actually disagree with that. Usually when there is a revolution, one elite is using the populist fervor of the masses against another. And we saw it get carried away exactly 100 years ago in Russia. We saw it get carried away in the French Revolution when wealth disparities were similar to America today. But the American Revolution was stage managed by very, very logical men and women. It was the calmest and most bourgeois and reasonable and moderate revolution. And that is what we should be militant and self-righteous in defending. We should be militantly defending a moderate revolution that has reformed itself incrementally over years. Each generation of Americans has taken on another of our faults, slavery, and then civil rights, and so on. And it's been incremental.
Well, I think surely there are some benefits to anger. As you said, the civil rights movement wouldn't have happened without self-righteous indignation. Protests over climate change wouldn't have happened. So much that's good and so much social change and social justice happens or begins with self-righteous indignation.
I absolutely agree. We have to look at all of the things, as the anthropologist Sarah Hurdy has pointed out. We should neither ignore what we were for a million years, cave dwellers, mammoth hunters, and living in feudalism, we should neither ignore our background nor let it limit us. And it would be ignoring our background to ignore the fact that many, many of our steps of progress were fueled by indignation. We should have this as one of our mental suites, mental states that we can get into when something is very wrong. But when it reaches the point where it's a drug that you can't say no to, that you can't walk away from and take a vacation from, that you can't calm down and sit down with people on the other side, here is the huge mistake. Look, I approve of a lot of the marching that's going on. Resistance, all that kind of thing. I guess I'm giving away my politics. But it's not going to be anywhere near as effective as finding just 5 to 10 million brainy, smart, and at their core sane conservatives who know something's wrong and sitting down and talking to them.
What's the dividing line for you? I mean, what's the difference between indignation as a moral virtue and indignation as a drug?
When you can, in the course of your actions, calm down enough to put indignation aside, then you know it's less an addiction and more a choice. When you're able to look in the mirror and say, I can see that this feels real good and that's one of the reasons I'm doing this, and I am going to downplay that as my main reason for being active in my political cause. When you notice that it's preventing you from listening to someone sincere who has a suggestion that doesn't fit your stereotypes, if it's preventing you from pragmatically mapping out how to achieve your goals, then it's counterproductive.
What if you go back to thinking of trying to balance, substitute one pleasure for another? Because you began by talking about this kind of indignation as addictive, and addictive because there is something very pleasurable about it. I'm not sure that trying to be a sane and rational and self-questioning person is quite as pleasurable as feeling absolutely certain that you're right. So what's another kind of pleasure that you could substitute?
Well, absolutely, but we do have examples. Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and especially Ronald Reagan were able to tap into not just indignation against injustice, but also hope, a carrot to go along with the stick. And there's so much to be hopeful about in our world. It's completely loony that we should be in this state of wrath when the last 70 years of the American pacts for all of our mistakes have been the greatest era in the history of humanity, with the most development, with the greatest peace. And we should be bragging about that, because only by bragging about that can we prevent some forces from saying everything we've done is a mistake. Let's try the old ways, the old feudalist ways, the old ways of thumping power. You know, we've done some things that are good, and we should brag about those in between the screams of denunciation.
David, thank you so much. That was great.
Oh, terrific. I hope we all just find some joy and become happy warriors.
Science fiction writer David Brin. So throughout this hour, we've been talking about anger and the role it can play in achieving social change. Yes, anger can separate us into partisan camps, but it can also inspire us to work together to achieve amazing things. Writer Michael Eric Dyson knows this firsthand, and his latest book, Tears We Cannot Stop, reads as a call to action to many Americans. He told Charles Monroe Kane why he wrote it.
You wrote this for white America. Obviously, it's in the title of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, because I think when white people, you know, hear about race, they think black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, let's talk about white people. See how uncomfortable it is? Then that's how uncomfortable it is for us. But you never think about that. you never have to peel back the layers and think about what it means to be white. And so I wanted to address white brothers and sisters, because if they don't change, ain't nothing happening, man. Black people can get converted and think about this in different ways. It makes no difference unless white brothers do, too, and sisters do, too.
So you said unless they change, or I guess I should say, I'm sorry, unless we change, I'm white. What do you expect?
I want the conversation to start. I want a conversion factor to happen. I want people's mind to open. I want them to think seriously about it, get angry, get upset, get mad, get resentful, but move and think about what this might mean.
You know, for you to write a book like this, when I looked through this, I saw a lot of grief. Was this really painful for you to write?
Extremely painful for me to write. It was painful because I had to dig beneath the objectivity of my scholarly craft and vocation and come up with a personal voice, something deep inside of me. See, partly my success has to do with keeping those feelings at bay, keeping a clinical distance between myself and that anger that might, you know, wrathfully articulate itself. And in order for me to be successful in white America, I have to suppress that anger. But now, writing this book, I have to unleash it. The heartbreak, the pain, the suffering, the grief. I wanted to communicate that.
You know, it's interesting, you know, for me, you know, I think that our country has never properly dealt with the legacy of slavery to Jim Crow. And I think mass incarceration is a major problem of race in our country. But I don't know what to do next. What should I do? What should we do, white people, do with the similar emotions?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think to speak out, for white people to say something about it, it's not just a black and brown problem. If white folk could get as enraged about that as about animals and weeping, and they should cry tears on television and weep over animals, but my God, stepping over the bodies of black and brown people to do so, it's not an either-or thing. You can be concerned about animals and concerned about human beings, but many black people think that white folk of a certain inclination care more about their animals than they do about their fellow human beings who are black and brown.
Do you think white people aren't empathetic to what's happening to you?
Well, often they are not, because it doesn't happen to them. Look, that's most human beings. That's not just white people. Yeah. You know, stuff happens to you. You own a red Corvette, you notice Corvettes more. Remember, as it was said, the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. And so Black Lives Matter says we matter. Stop thinking that we don't matter. So, yeah, there is a lack of empathy, for sure.
You know, it's interesting. I'm reading your book, and I'm struck again now hearing you talk. The answer seems so clear hearing you talk. It's diversity. I need to make sure that I go out of my way to create a lifestyle where I'm around people who are black, just to understand what's happening. We all need to be eating food together. You know what I mean? That's what we need to be doing.
Yeah, it sounds simple, but it's so true, man. And when you meet other people, when you have a black friend and or many black friends, and you see how they're treated, and you know, damn, I did the same thing.
Right.
I didn't get treated like that. So you can readily answer for us as people of color. We're going to commission you and deputize you right now to go back to white America.
Okay.
You could tell the truth in a way that many white brothers and sisters seem not to know.
I was thinking, when I think about diversity, I think about people I know that are white, that are well-intentioned, if I can use that. And they have this fear, and it's a different fear than you have. And our big fear is that we get involved in the black church, or we get involved somewhere civically, and we make a mistake. And when we make a mistake, we're considered racist, and we're scared to death. Like, you calling me a racist right now for something I said would just destroy me. So we're so afraid of it, and so fragile, and so insecure in who we are, that we're afraid to engage because we're afraid to be called that. What should we do with that?
Yeah, that's a great point, and it's honest. And I can understand that, honestly. You know, I can understand. As a man, I'm trying to be a feminist, but dang, I mess up and the ladies are going to call me, wow, you're still a sexist. Well, you know what? Do they suffer more than my hurt feelings? I think so. Is rape worse than my hurt feelings? I think so. But when you win people over and they see you're sincere, even when you make a mistake, they're going to say, you know what, but that person has a good heart. They're really trying to do the right thing. They're really here in there swinging with us. And you get different kind of brownie points, literally, and different kind of
I'm deputizing and getting brownie points. This is a great day.
So, you know, it's a different situation. And, yeah, there's a risk, but the reward is greater. Mm-hmm. That, I think, outweighs whatever risk one might take in order to render that service.
Yeah, I got to ask you a question. I'm sitting last night reading your book, And by chance, my wife, she has a copy. It's a book version of Langston Hughes's Let America Be America Again. And I've never read it. So I pick it up and I read it. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's righteous. It has a very similar message. And it struck me, it was written 80 years ago. And I'm like, what has really changed? How do you keep hope alive?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I talked to Jesse Jackson, the author of that phrase, and that's one way I do it. Keep hope alive. But, you know, you said something important there. It's hope. It's not optimism. Optimism is a shallow virtue. It's predicated upon reading the tea leaves and seeing if we're going to have a positive versus a negative outcome and what is the likelihood. But hope is something against the obvious, against the evident, the revealed world in juxtaposition to an imagined world. You know, I question many elements of the revealed religion and how people practice it, because I got a lot of arguments with that. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, my religion is love. I don't care if you claim you'd be a Christian like me, you're a believer like me, but if you believe in some of this madness of homophobia and sexism and racism, I'm not down with you. And if you claim to be an atheist, but you're practicing love and doing the right thing, then that's my religion. So I know that doesn't sit well with a lot of people, but that's what I believe.
Michael Eric Dyson. He was talking with Charles Monroe Cain about his new book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. That's it for this hour, but there is more in our podcast feed. If you like this show, do us a favor. Leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. That helps other people find us. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour with help from Charles Monroe Cain, Mark Rickers, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.